Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm glad you could join us today because we're going to do something really special. The 2017 New Yorker Festival just took place this month, and we're going to be bringing you some of the highlights throughout the year. First up today is an interview with Chelsea Manning, who was convicted for sending military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks, 750,000 documents. Manning was recently released from prison, and she spoke with Larissa McFarker, who's been a staff writer here since 1998.
Yep, that's right.
Larissa, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Chelsea Manning's case was front page news all over the world. So could you take us back a little bit and tell us exactly what was at stake in this?
So Chelsea Manning, she was then known as Bradley Manning. She was an Army intelligence analyst who, through her work, had access to all kinds of internal government documents, also videos. And some had to do with the area she was charged with analyzing, which was dangers and significant events on the ground in Iraq while she was there, which was the late 2000s. But she also had access to hundreds of thousands of cables from the State Department, some going back many years, and those were included in her leak. And, you know, at the time in 2010, of course, Rafi Khachaturian published a major piece about WikiLeaks in that year, but this was earlier in that year, and it was still a very tiny organization that had published quite a few secret documents. Some were protocols for the management of Guantanamo, for instance, or the contents of Sarah Palin's private Yahoo account. But it wasn't a big player on the scene. It wasn't yet widely known. And, of course, when it published her documents, all of that changed.
And as if that weren't complicated enough, the day after the sentence was handed down, Manning's lawyers announced that Bradley Manning was transitioning to life as a woman. And she, Chelsea Manning, immediately became one of the most famous trans people in the world, didn't she?
She did. She became a hero to many people for being brave enough to announce her identity in that way when she had the world's attention.
So Manning was released less than 5 months ago. She served 7 years of what was originally a 35-year sentence, which has been criticized as excessive. How was it for her to talk about the leaks?
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. She wants to focus on the future, on her activism, on her life out of prison. But, of course, we want to know what she has to say about the past.
One thing that I was curious to learn when I was reading about you, things that I didn't know, was that you said you originally grew up with conservative views inherited from your father, and that you gradually changed your views in the course of your childhood. Could you describe how you changed and why?
So I grew up in central Oklahoma, a small town, Crescent, Oklahoma. And, you know, my parents were both, you know, voting Republicans. And, you know, I wasn't aware that there was another alternative. You know, it was just like everybody is, you know, holds these views, or at least says that they hold these views. So, you know, and I didn't really understand them. So
what started you to change your mind?
Well, I mean, It's not so much that you change your mind. It's, you know, like I'm trans, and I felt different than everybody else. I knew I was different. I didn't have words to like describe that. All of my friends, all my family, all the teachers, they all knew it as well. Like it felt like there was something about me that was different. That it caused friction and it caused difficulty for me.
And I know that this was not the only thing you were contending with as a kid.
Right.
At a certain point, you moved from this town in Oklahoma to Wales, where your mother was from. I think the immediate cause of it was your parents split up. Is that right?
So my mother's British, and my mother and my father split up. My mother decided to move back to the UK, and so I spent 4 years there. I went to school there, and you know, it was different. You know, I was like a kid from the Midwest. You know, like, I didn't fit in. I didn't know it was just a completely different world for me.
So I understand that you were spending a lot of time, as I can imagine, like online, looking for connections to people who felt more like you. Can you tell me a bit about that, like what that meant to you at the time?
So my father exposed me to computers at a young age. You know, I learned how to program by the time I was 8 or 9, although I didn't fully understand it probably until I was about 10. And my parents always had, we always had a computer in the house, and we always had internet access in the house. So it was a normal thing for me, you know, even though at the time in the early to mid 90s, it was, I guess, not, I mean, it wasn't a normal thing. And there was a lot of communities on the internet in this time. And so I was exploring like who I was, exploring different ways of presenting myself. I spent more time text messaging and instant messaging my friends than actually spending time with them, you know.
Right.
You know, and the term was IRL, but you know, like we weren't spending a whole lot of time IRL.
Right. You've said that when you were in Wales with your mother, you were, she really didn't know how to drive. She hadn't, when she was married to your mother, she hadn't used the checkbook. She hadn't been involved in the finances at all.
Right.
So you were the one taking care of that.
I was, yes. My mother didn't know how to write checks, so I used the internet to learn how. Like it ended up being a symbiotic relationship, you know. But also my mother had, you know, she had a drinking problem. And as I got older, I realized how bad it was.
Right.
And I love my mother. It just, you know, like I realized that this was not the kind of environment that I needed to be in at that time. So I decided to move after my mother had a medical problem happen, and it was a scare for me because I realized that if something had happened to my mother, I didn't have a backup plan. I didn't have anywhere else to go, you know. So
at a certain point, you moved back, and you had a rough period when you moved back with your dad and your stepmother, right?
Right. So, and I've never called her my stepmother. I want to make that clear. I called her dad's wife.
Okay.
We didn't get along, to say the least. And you know, so I moved back. I was 17. And I moved back to the States, and it was just very difficult because she didn't like me, and so she was creating all these rules that were impossible to follow. You know, in
like what?
You know, like you can't leave your bedroom after 8 p.m. So she called. I mean, she called the police on me one night after an argument.
What happened?
It was over a sandwich because I wanted to have a sandwich. So it was 8:30 at night. So I went out of the room and I used her kitchen, you know, after like 8 o'clock or whatever to like make a sandwich. And I was like a Swiss cheese and bologna sandwich, and I would cut it with a knife. And so, like, you know, I had the knife in the hand. I wasn't, like, wielding it or anything like that. And then she ran off and, like, called the police on me. And I'm just like, okay, that's weird. So the, you know, Oklahoma City Police Department knocked on the door. And I'm like, hello? And they're like, we're here for a domestic incident. And I was like, okay, like, she's in there, you know, like... so, like, you know, the police officer understood what was going on and was, you know, he basically said, you shouldn't come back there.
So what happened after that? I mean, you described yourself as basically homeless.
Yeah.
You went on the road, you had a truck.
Like, I borrowed my dad's truck.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And where did you go?
So I ended up driving to Chicago, and I lived on the streets of Chicago for summer in Chicago, and there I am living out of a pickup truck and dealing with that.
Ultimately, you ended up at your aunt's house.
Right.
In Maryland. How did that happen? Did she find you?
Yeah. So she did some detective work. And she asked around all the people that I used to hang out with. She told me that she called about 50 or 60 people until she finally found somebody that had my cell phone number. So I get a call from my aunt, and she was like, you know, come to my house. And I did. I drove a night and a day all the way to Maryland, and I lived with her for a year. You know, it was so wonderful for her to be there for me at a time like this. And I realize now that she saved, you know, she really saved my life in many ways. And I didn't realize it. I didn't understand it at the time because I was so used to being in crisis mode.
Right.
That even whenever I was there, I was like, this is temporary. So I was scared. And I was, you know, I was also trying to reestablish a relationship with my father.
Mm-hmm.
And so I calling him, you know, he kept on saying, like, you need structure. You need the military. I was in the Navy for 4 years. Like, you should go into the Navy or the Air Force. And at that time, the Iraq War was going on. So I saw the images on TV every day of chaos and violence in Baghdad. And I really wanted to do something, you know. And I joined the Army because, you know, that was where, you know, it was Baghdad. It was where the fight was, you know. And I wanted to help, you know, with that. You know, I thought, if I become an intelligence analyst, you know, I can use my like skills or learn something and like make a difference, you know, and maybe stop this.
So you go to work as an intelligence analyst in Iraq. Could you describe what you were doing from day to day? What did your work involve?
Right. So back then, like before I deployed, it was statistics. It was just a bunch of numbers and databases with just a bunch of like, you know, network analysis of different, you know, suspected groups. It was a lot to take in, but it was all abstract. And whenever I got to Iraq, I was actually there. And it made a huge difference in my understanding of everything. Because I'm like, for the first time in my life, you know, I'm looking at a data set and I had faces to them. I had people to them. And it was just overwhelming because it was 30 to 100, you know, emails and reports a day that I was getting. It was like drinking from a fire hose. And it's just a fire hose of like death and destruction and mayhem just every single day. And it's normal. It's like being in a trauma ward, you know, like, and somebody asks you like, what's the most traumatic thing that happened today? And you're just like, it's, you know, like, it's just everything. You're just completely overwhelmed by all of this stuff. And having faces and names and realizing that these weren't just statistics and you know, figures inside of a database. This was a real thing. And that was a really, it was a very difficult thing for me to deal with.
And so at the same time as you're having this stuff flooding your brain,
right.
Of course, you're dealing with another enormous personal issue as well,
yeah.
Thinking about transitioning. And you said that, I believe you spent your first day in public as a woman on leave from Iraq.
I did.
In 2010. Can you just tell us about that day?
So, yeah, I cross-dressed in private on a number of occasions, you know, as a kid and as a teenager. And it was, you know, something I felt ashamed of. When I got back from Iraq on mid-tour leave, you know, it's a 10-day leave, after seeing everything that I had saw, you know, I just realized how important it is to live the life that we live, because I'd seen so many people just, you know, dying all the time. And there was always this fear that, you know, like, you know, the person that I see in the dining facility won't make it back. And that had happened. I realized that I need to be who I am. And I wasn't afraid. You know, it was for the first, like that was what was so shocking about me being out there for the first time as a woman, was like this like shame or fear or whatever that was stopping me before was completely gone. You know, I went to the mall, so I mean, people weren't paying attention to me. You know, it was just a very normal day, and I didn't feel this self-consciousness, because I've always felt this self-consciousness about, am I being tough enough? Am I being manly enough? Am I being, you know, am I fitting in? Am I meeting the standards that everybody, you know, is expecting me to be? And it was just gone. It was just like, I don't have to meet anybody's standards or expectations.
And In your clemency application late last year, your attorney wrote, quote, many of Ms. Manning's fellow soldiers teased and bullied her because she was different. And these events had a detrimental effect on her mentally and emotionally, leading to the disclosures.
I've kind of struggled with this, because I've never said that I was teased and bullied by my colleagues.
Okay.
You know, but like whenever I describe what I went through, people describe it as that.
Okay.
Maybe it's something that we just did in military culture, where we just justify it. You know, we just find it as normal. Like, it's just banter. It's just...
Right. But regardless of whether it was coming from your fellow soldiers or just... like, how did the turmoil that you were going through in terms of thinking about transitioning, how did that affect your disclosures later on, as your attorney says?
I don't think it did. I don't think they're connected. I see the, like, endless stream of violence and death and destruction as being the primary motivator.
Okay. So what was it that you wanted to expose? Was there specific things?
No, it's the whole thing. I don't, you know, it's like what little thing is there? You know, is it this one little thing? Or is it this whole thing? And it's the whole thing. You know, it's everything that I saw. You know, war, it's the best and worst of humanity all wrapped in one. And, you know, that the video that everybody,
right,
you know, the that's now called Collateral Murder, you know, like in that video, it's if you really watch it and you watch it closely, you can see both the best parts of humanity and the worst parts of humanity all rolled up
in
one.
Can you describe it in case anyone doesn't know?
I can't legally do that. I can't describe what's in the video. They don't have the authorization.
Roughly, what this video is it shows U.S. soldiers attacking people on the ground from a helicopter and killing some, including a couple of Reuters journalists. And then subsequently, a van comes along, perhaps to come to the rescue of people who are wounded on the ground, and they also attack the van, and there were some children in the van. This incident had been known about, but people had not seen the video, and Reuters had been trying to get it, and they had not succeeded. So this is one of the things that was disclosed.
Yeah, and you know, and it's a very deep and complex video, and it's not a simple thing. And people have tried to simplify it, and it's not. It's very complex, and it's the complexity of it all, and like the overwhelmingness of it all. And you know, it's not intel. You know, these aren't intelligence documents. They're not intelligence. They are historic. It's what happened. It's a historical record of everything that happened. Everybody's conflating all of it, and it just, I don't know.
So tell about what you, I mean, I believe that before you went to WikiLeaks, you first approached the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Yes.
And then you ultimately went to WikiLeaks. Could you just explain how that went? How much time did you have? What did you try to do?
So I had 10 days, and I spent one of those days seeing, you know, my boyfriend at the time.
Right.
And things were not working out. And I live in D.C., and I didn't feel comfortable or secure in, like, showing up to just meet up with reporters. So I tried to call them. I didn't trust email. I didn't trust, like, my own phone calls. So I made the decision to take the metro to different locations that I'd never really been to before, and find a Starbucks and, like, use the public phone. I knew from when I worked at Starbucks, because I worked at Starbucks for a while, that at the time they had phones, like, in, you know, where it would, you'd answer the phone to, like, you know, answer whether or not the store is open or not. So I'd use that phone. I'd be like, hey, can I use this phone? Like, my car broke down. And they'd say yes, you know. So I'd pick it up, and I would call, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and I was trying to explain, like, what it was, and, like, I was trying to establish encrypted communications. You know, like, I was like, hey, can you install PGP, or can you install GPG? Can you install these tools? And they struggled. You know, they're like, why can't you just show up? Why can't you just tell me over the phone?
Why did you go to them first, not WikiLeaks?
Because I saw all the president's men, you know? Like, I just... That was the New York Times made, I mean, the Washington Post made sense because I saw that movie. That was really, I mean, it is as simple as that.
And now WikiLeaks, it's gone a whole road since back then. What did you know about WikiLeaks in 2010? It was much more obscure organization.
Well, I mean, yeah, it was. And, you know, I wasn't really a part of, like, you know, like, it was like, I was running out of time and I was running out of decisions, and, like, they just had the tools available. They knew how to use them. And that was it. That's all it boiled down to, is, like, I had to go back to Iraq. You know, and the snowstorm happened. So I spent 3 days without power, without internet, you know, without heat. You know, and we were snowed in because it was a big blizzard.
Right.
Like, it was difficult. It was a communications problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was placed in, I had to make decisions in a short period of time. Based upon every, you know, I made the decision, like, this is what, and I wrote, you know, I wrote this note, and everybody's like, it's to WikiLeaks, but it's not a note to them. It's a note to the recipient, whoever that is, because I was running out of time. I just had no options.
Yeah. So the difference, one of the differences between if you had sent it to the Times, or if they'd had the technology to receive it in a secure way, the Times or the Post, would have probably redacted names. And Assange, now, Julian Assange, the head of...
I'm not going to get into this debate right now. I can't.
Yeah.
I'm legally obligated to not discuss any of this.
Okay. What I was...
there's this discussion. We've presented our own case, and it's closed. Like, we can't talk about it, so...
Just to say, what I was going to ask was, you know, it's a policy of newspapers generally to redact names to protect the identities of people who might be in danger. And the head of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, believes in much more complete transparency, and he believes that it would contaminate the evidence, to use his phrase, if you did redact those names. And so he did not, in some cases, which potentially endangered informants, particularly in Afghanistan.
We strongly dispute those facts.
Okay.
We strongly dispute those facts. The government was not able to show any indication
of
that.
Yes.
Zero.
Yeah. Did you not fear sending out these things that you didn't know what was in them? Did you not?
I did know what was in them. I work with this information every day.
But the 250,000 documents, did you not fear that it might hurt someone if you didn't know exactly what
was in them? Absolutely not. It's historical data. The government frames this in a particular way, but they don't bring facts. They never tell you anything. Like, they just assume that you're going to believe what they say. And they've never been able to bring this even before a court. It's historical data. I worked with it every single day. There's nothing sensitive in there. There's no troop movements. It's all in the past. It was 2 months old by the time I even uploaded it. It was a historical record of everything that had happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. The notion that it contains troop movements or, you know, mission critical data or anything like that is not the case. It's not in there. And we've proven that repeatedly.
And were you not worried about the identities of informants or not?
There's no identities of informants. You know, we have sources and are held in a completely different compartment of information. And I had access to that compartment, but that's not the information in this. There's no source information in this.
Okay.
It's not there. It's people dying and people getting killed and people suffering and on a massive, incredible scale that we've never had this record before. It's what happened. It's not the future or it's not like it's historical data. And I have to go back to the statement because there's a particular statement that's been vetted, that I read at the court martial, and that's pretty much the left and right parameters of what I can talk about with the information. But that's always been our position, is that this is historical information, and they've never asserted, you know, any realistic interpretation of that being that way.
That's Chelsea Manning talking with The New Yorker's Larissa McFarker. Their interview took place earlier this month, about 4 months after Manning was released from prison. We're going to continue that conversation, but Larissa, first, Manning just made some strong assertions about what was in, and more to the point, what was not in, the documents she gave to WikiLeaks. We're talking about 750,000 documents. What do we know for sure, and how much is in dispute about the sensitivity of the leak itself?
Well, what is in dispute is whether or not anyone was actually killed as a result of the leaks. But what we do know for sure is that Chelsea Manning did not know what was in all those documents. She just did not have time to read all of them. And she calls them historical. Several times she calls them historical. But what she means by that is, in many cases, just a couple of months old. And what they may not have included is information about current troop movements. But of course, they reveal a lot besides that.
She says there were no names of sources, nothing that can endanger anyone, and the government disputes that to this day?
Absolutely, and it's not just the government that disputes that. She did deny it, as you heard, but there were names of many Afghan informants. And, of course, you know, it made little difference to these informants that the documents referred to were a couple of months old because these people were still in danger. And, you know, in response to when the documents were released, the Department of Defense set up a task force to try to protect these people. It then forwarded information about these people to commanders in Afghanistan who, in some cases, sent soldiers to find them. And this, of course, put those soldiers in danger.
So just to be clear, your disagreement resides in, let's say The New Yorker got this, or The New York Times or The Washington Post. What would have been the key difference?
They would have redacted names of people whose lives would have been put in danger, potentially, as a result of publication. So WikiLeaks did work in part with The New York Times and The Guardian to publish the material, and the newspapers did want to redact the names, but Assange refused, as I said in the interview. And this led Amnesty International, the Open Society Institute, the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, and the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission all to join together and condemn what Assange had done. You know, this was a very, very big deal. A lot of people who make it their business to protect people such as those Afghan informants felt that this had put them in danger.
That's Larissa McFarker, staff writer at The New Yorker. And we'll hear more from her interview with Chelsea Manning in just a moment. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back. Ahead on the show today, we'll hear a conversation with Riz Ahmed, the British actor and rapper and activist who won an Emmy for his performance in HBO's The Night Of. Stick around. I think you'll enjoy it. And now we're going to go back to Larissa McFarker's conversation with Chelsea Manning, the former Army intelligence analyst who in 2010 sent WikiLeaks a gigantic trove of military and diplomatic documents dealing with the Iraq War. The leak profoundly embarrassed the United States government and put WikiLeaks on the map as a force to be reckoned with.
I know what you were hoping for. You wanted to expose what was going on in Iraq. You wanted the public to know how the war was being conducted. What would you say is the best result of what happened as a result of the information that you distributed?
Look, I haven't had the time to deal with these questions. Like, all I've been doing is fighting for my life for the last 7 years. You know, the first thing that happened for the first 2 months is I was completely cut off from the world. I had no idea about the debate that was raging in the world because I was completely cut off from it. I was in solitary confinement in a cage in Iraq or in Kuwait at the time.
You know, tell us about that. Like, how did they keep you before trial? What happened to you when you were?
So when I got to Kuwait, I was in a cage and they put me into basically it was a cell. It was about the size of a cell. I won't forget it, but like the metalworking was done in Fort Wayne, Indiana, because it had it written on it, and that's a very strong memory. So it's a cage with another cage beside it in a tent, and so they kept me there. They kept me in this for 60 days, and you know I lost it. I didn't know what was going on in the world. I didn't have access to my attorneys. I didn't have access to television, newspapers, radio. I didn't know anything about anything that was going on. I was completely cut off. Nobody would tell me anything. There were times I thought I was never going to get out of there. I was never going to get out of that cage.
And can you explain, I mean, later an official at the UN described the way you were kept both there and later in Quantico as something like torture. Could you try to explain, like, what is it that is so incredibly difficult about being kept in solitary confinement in the kind of conditions that you were kept in?
It's the fact it's solitary confinement. You know, humans are a social creature. Like, we need connections. We need to be with each other. We need comfort. We need love. We need family. And I didn't have that in that situation. I don't know how else to describe that other than to sit in, you know, like just go to your bathroom and close the door and, like, don't leave for a whole day and just see how that feels. That's what it is, except it doesn't stop. Like, I learned how to deal with that, but only, you know, whenever I was in Quantico, I had two Marines outside the door at all times. And I would be sitting there not doing anything, but like I had to sit upright. I couldn't lay down. They said you couldn't lay down. And I'm like, why can't I lay down? They're like, because it's the rules. I had no power. I had no ability to argue anything or do anything. And I tried to play by the rules, but they were impossible rules. You know, it felt like my stepmother, you know, like it was just this impossible set of rules. And, you know, like it was funny because like I wasn't allowed to exercise, but I needed to exercise. It was driving me nuts. So I started dancing and they're like, you know, the Marines were like, it doesn't say anything about dancing in the rules. So they let me dance. And I was just like, okay, that's how I exercise.
Wow.
It's like Zumba.
I mean, one very, very striking thing that you said, despite this terrible experience that you had before your trial, that at the time when you were facing this incredibly long prison sentence, 35 years, you were more pained by the thought of not being able to live as a woman than by the sentence.
Yeah, so, you know, I've really just given up on trying to pretend to be somebody else. You know, there was no way I was going to meet everybody's expectations of what, you know, being a male is. But when I didn't realize how important it was until I was placed into a position where, you know, it felt like it was never going to happen.
And somehow, I mean, you describe this moment when you're going to prison as you're thinking it's never going to happen, but you kept fighting. What gave you the sense that you could someday win this battle, which you did win? Or is it just you had no choice? You had.
I lived from day to day. I was like, okay, these are achievable goals. I'm gonna have breakfast. I'm gonna have lunch. I'm gonna have dinner. I'm gonna go to sleep. I set myself small, achievable goals that I could meet and that I could accomplish every single day, And that's what I focused on. But like, the main thing that helped me survive was, I used to say it was from chow to chow. You know, like I would live from chow to chow. Right. I would live from breakfast to lunch to dinner to sleep. Breakfast to lunch to dinner to sleep. Like, it was very grounding.
You received incredible numbers of letters of support in prison. How, I can't remember the number.
I know it was over 200,000.
Wow. And you said that a lot of them had glitter in them.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. some of them had glitter, yes.
which you had to clean up.
Yeah.
Inconvenient.
They don't clean that up for you. You have to clean that up.
In terms of issues you're going to work on in the future, trans rights is one big one that you're going to be focusing your energies on. And I was wondering, you mentioned when we talked before that you thought the focus, the enormous focus over the past few years on marriage equality was a really bad one.
Right.
Tell us why you feel like that was a mistake.
It's not that I don't support marriage equality.
Right.
I want to make that clear.
Right. But the focus.
I worried about how it was framed. We have these inherent rights, and like we're asking them to like give us rights again. And I don't like how that's framed. I didn't like how it was framed. I thought it was a goal that didn't help. It didn't help homeless queer kids. It didn't help homeless trans kids. You know, I was a homeless genderqueer kid, and how is marriage equality going to help me in that situation?
What would have helped you in that situation? What do you think should
housing?
That's right.
But food? Like.
So how are you going to work for that particular issue? Like, what is your plan?
My plan is to fight. I think the most important thing that we have to learn, because I think it's been forgotten, is that every single one of us has the ability to change things. Each and every one of us has this ability. We need to look to each other and realize what our values are, what we care about, and then assert them and say these things and to take, you know, actions in our political discourse to make that happen, because it's not going to happen at the ballot box. It's not.
So before he left office, as we know, Obama commuted your sentence, and you are now an icon to many people who believe that the government needs to be more transparent, not just in war, but in general. If someone, let's say a young programmer, comes to you who wants to work for more government transparency, what would you suggest?
Make your own decisions, make your own choices, make your own judgment.
Are there specific things that they could do to further that particular cause?
No, I mean, you have to pay attention. You have to pay attention, especially if you're, you know, for engineers in particular, we design, we develop systems, but the systems that, you know, we develop can be used for different things. The software that I was using in Iraq, you know, for predictive, you know, analysis was the same that you would use in marketing. It's the same tools. It's the same analysis. I believe engineers and software engineers and technologists, it's a new term that came out while I was away.
Yeah.
I guess technologists should, you know, realize that we have an ethical obligation to make decisions that go beyond just meeting deadlines or creating a product. Let's actually take some chunks of time and say, wait, what are the consequences of the system? How can this be used? How can this be misused? Let's try to figure out, you know, how we can mitigate a software system from being misused, or, you know, decide whether or not you want to implement it at all. You know, there are systems that, if misused, can be very dangerous.
I have no doubt that perhaps younger people who are interested in specific government transparency will go to you for advice and ask about leaking to expose government wrongdoing.
Yeah, they don't come to me for that.
They don't?
They don't come to me for that.
Chelsea Manning. She was released from military prison about 5 months ago and spoke with Larissa McFarker at the New Yorker Festival earlier this month. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm David Remnick. Next time on our podcast, the Emmy Award-winning actor and rapper and activist Riz Ahmed. I think you'll enjoy it. See you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with special help from the staff of the New Yorker Festival, Rhonda Sherman, Alexis Goldberg, David Ohana, Bradley G., and Hillary Lechter Griffin. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.